Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Chris is just trying to, he's just trying to fix his headphones right now.
He's trying to jam right now.
Chris, you jamming?
No, I'm just nearly paired with my neighbor's TV by accident.
It is Thursday, which means it's time for the Front 3 Q&A podcast with me, Adam Boltwood, the man, the myth, the legend, Chris Hennage.
Even.
And Nico Morales is here as well.
Wow, what an intro.
Yeah, I just thought I'd downplay it for yourself, Nico. Guys, we're here to A, your cues. You've been sending them in on Twitter. It's a proper Q&A podcast tonight for the first time in ages.
Sexual assault in some countries.
Yes, as they say. Not actually that much to talk about. There's not much going on in the world of football, I don't think. There's a little bit of transfer talk, I guess, we could discuss. We'll get into that on the podcast. But before that, it is Thursday, which means for the first time in a while, it's time for Hole of the Week. Guys, our favourite review of the week. If you want to get involved, if you want to be Hole of the Week, all you have to do is click on the link in the description of the podcast. Get your reviews in on iTunes for the Front 3. Rate and review the podcast. There's actually only one contender this week. Not many reviews coming in, which should be the incentive, guys, to get involved, because John Rabb from the USA has won the Ferrero Rocher this week. Zero competition with his 5-star review on iTunes. John says, I never miss a podcast. These are super informative and, in my opinion, really improve my knowledge of the game. All the guys bring their own perspective. Great hosts, both Adam and occasionally Lawrence, do a wonderful job moving the podcast along and not allowing the conversation to get stagnant. Keep up the great work and I will keep coming back for more. Smiley face. John Rabb, you've earned yourself a 6-pack of Ferrero Rocher there. Get involved on Twitter, DM me, or at the Front 3 to claim those beautiful chocolates. Let's get into the questions and let's get into the answers, though. We're still waiting for the Alexis Sanchez transfer to be confirmed, but as far as we all know, he is on his way to Manchester United. The specifics of the deal yet to be finalised. Is Henrik Mkhitaryan going the other way? Probably yes. Is there a fee involved? Probably yes. What we do know is that the deal is worth a potential £180 million over the course of 4.5 years, according to reports in the British press. That includes the transfer fee, the agent fee, the signing on fee, the wages. It's an extraordinary amount of money. All the talk was a week ago. It was going to be Manchester City who were signing Sanchez. All of a sudden, Manchester United are the favourites now to sign the Chilean. What do you make of this, Nico?
It's an interesting one. There's obviously a lot of moving pieces and there's a lot of aspects to the deal that I think are both negative and positive for Manchester United. So I think the first thing that I kind of thought of when, maybe not the first thing, but as I sort of molded over, as I've talked to different people about it, is, you know, they do have very little South American representation in the first 11 at Manchester United. And we know Manchester United's MO. What's his name? I forget. Ed Woodward said a couple of years ago in an interview that he wanted Manchester United to be the Real Madrid of the Premier League. And in that sense, you know, they were the first. They are a club that's like historically good at being at like in, you know, intruding markets and stuff like that. They were the first into the Asian market with players like Park Ji-sung and all the marketing that they did over there. So having a marquee player like Alexis Sanchez from sort of that marketing perspective is a very good thing for them. Now, on the field and sort of the more normal club logistics, I don't know if it's the greatest deal because you're paying what is reported to be $500,000 or 500,000 euros or pounds a week to a player who's 29, hasn't had much rest since like the 2013 summer, because he, you know, is involved with competitions with Arsenal in Chile every summer. He supposedly causes issues in the dressing room. As I said before, he's quite old. And for a number of years now, as I've said many times on this podcast, and why I wasn't too keen on him for joining City, was that he's ruined Arsenal's defensive shape for a couple of years now because of the way that he goes about himself off the ball. And while Jose Mourinho might be able to fix that, and he might be able to either implement him in a system where that doesn't affect the team too much, or actually convince him to, you know, defend properly, it's still a bit of a weird one to spend this much money in terms of wages on a player that is going to give you no resale value and really only going to be useful for another 2 to 3 years. And that's if Jose Mourinho stays all the way.
At 29 years old, I mean, as you mentioned there, there is that lack of a resale value, but you think he's going to produce the immediate results on the pitch in the near future, at the end of this season, next season, in order to potentially justify that move. There's talk of Mourinho potentially playing him on the right wing, could be the space where he could fit into this side with Martial, with Rashford having that left wing side covered.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to cast any aspersions out there as a City fan as to, you know, saying that he's not a good player. I think he is a really good player, and I think he'll be really successful on the pitch in the second half, even in the second half of the season. I think he'll score tons of goals because I think Jose Mourinho has identified him as a player that he can get the best out of. But like I said before, my issues with the transfer are not so much on the field, at least in the immediate, but rather just kind of, you know, the money and the age and the fact that he has had niggling injuries over the past couple of years. But like I said before, there is a lot of stuff that makes sense here. Another thing that I want to throw in there is that, you know, in addition to the fact that he will be a major, you know, marketing advantage for Manchester United that are looking to be a global brand, I would say this deal also makes sense in the sense that, you know, we all knew that City were in for Sanchez. They wanted another weapon just to, you know, overload everything that they have. And if you can take away a transfer from a rival, maybe not so much this season, but next season for the title, I think it's another, you know, piece to the puzzle as to why Manchester United would spend X amount of money of their wage budget on a player who is, as we've talked about, 29 years old.
What for City then? I mean, how much of a black eye is this losing Sanchez? I mean, it's debatable how much they needed him. As you say, maybe he could have been another weapon in the Arsenal as they go for this sort of all-conquering season, be it the Premier League, Champions League, the Cups as well, domestically. I mean, there's a report in The Independent this evening about how Manchester City are planning to press ahead with plans to upgrade their front line in the summer after missing out on Sanchez. According to Jack Pitbrook in The Independent, they want to sign a new first-team winger and a centre-forward with Aguero's future up in the air. I mean, what do you make of that? Do you buy into that report? Do you think the City do need reinforcements in those areas now that Sanchez isn't coming to the Etihad Stadium?
No, not really. I mean, I think for a number of years now, similar to other strikers, Aguero has just been that name that papers kind of push out there because, first of all, because I don't think he doesn't speak English very well, and his management team aren't really that quick to respond to these claims. But every time that it has gotten more serious and people have actually continued to ask him press conference after press conference as to what his future is, he always suggests that, you know, I will finish my European career at Manchester City and I will go back to, I think, his boyhood club. I think it was Boca Juniors or maybe River Plate, and finish my, you know, full professional career there. So I don't really think that City need to reinforce in the attacking department, as we were kind of talking about previous to recording. I think the major areas that City will strengthen, whether it be now in January or in the summer, are sort of in midfield as a Fernandinho replacement, because he has been so key for Manchester City, but he is 32 or 33 years old, and you can't put that many miles on a player in one season and not expect a little bit of blowback. So players like Jean-Michel Seri at Nice, or Fred from Shakhtar Donetsk have been identified. And I think those are probably the most realistic replacements for that player. Yeah.
What do you make of all this chat, Chris? There's obviously a lot of discussion around this move. Some saying this Sanchez is going for the money. At Man City, he could have had a guaranteed Premier League trophy, but he's going for the wedge. He's going for the bunts with Mourinho. How much do you put in that theory?
Not a huge amount personally, and I say that because I don't look at it from the perspective of where he is going. I look at it at the perspective of where he is leaving. And I really don't think it's a case of he's choosing money over trophies or what have you, whatever you prescribe Pep Guardiola's benefits to be. I think he's just desperate to leave Arsenal. I think he's become so almost disillusioned and I would say even apathetic towards that club now. And it's a consistent, vicious cycle of maybe a few good wins and then a defeat that feels avoidable, etc., etc. And I think he senses that it's falling down a little bit more. And I think he's purely thought, you know, I just want to change. And if I do it now, you know, it ends what I would consider his nightmare at Arsenal. It gives him a fairly decent pay packet as well. Moving in the summer for free would do that. But I think he just wants some certainty about his situation now. I think there's perhaps part of him that maybe, be it through himself or his agent, is acting with a bit of self-awareness and accepting that come the summer, there's a chance that maybe those clubs, Man United, Man City, for example, even Chelsea, if you want to consider them a viable candidate in this race, will look for players that are younger and can do what he can do. Because he is 29, and I don't think it matters if you believe he's going to burn out. Signing a 29-year-old is, I think, pretty much always a risky thing, maybe a goalkeeper aside. And so, yeah, I think he's very much striking while the iron is hot.
Of course, there is another factor in this whole Sanchez deal, and that is Arsenal. As Chris has mentioned there, George Douglas writes in on Twitter, would signing Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang make it a successful transfer window for Arsenal, even if Sanchez goes to Manchester United? You can't argue it's been spectacular mismanagement on Arsenal's part to let Sanchez run down his contract as well as Ozil to the point where now Sanchez is leaving for, albeit 30 million, as reports lead us to believe. That is a cut price deal. I mean, let's deal with the Mkhitaryan part of this equation first, Nico. Does that make sense for Arsenal? Do you think that's a good move if he comes to the Emirates Stadium?
Well, as you're saying there, I don't think it's as catastrophic a mismanagement if they were to get Mkhitaryan in the return, and plus some cash. Because for me, I think he is 1 year younger than Sanchez, which obviously doesn't make a huge difference, but it's not as bad as 29. You know, 28 isn't as bad as 29. But I, you know, a lot of people are saying, you know, they don't, a lot of Arsenal fans are suggesting, you know, they don't really want Mkhitaryan. They'd rather just take a large heap of money that they could reinvest elsewhere. But I think, you know, that's a little disingenuous to the talent of a player like Mkhitaryan, just because he hasn't had the best spell at Manchester United under a manager that perhaps didn't know how to use him best, or maybe expected a little bit more from him in certain situations where he hasn't been shown to thrive anyways, is something that has decreased his value. But I think he's a really talented player. And as we've seen over the past couple of weeks, there have been tons of really good articles from both statistics and narrative people that are talking about, you know, how do you replace Alexis Sanchez and presumably Mesut Ozil? And if you have players coming in basically for free plus cash, like Mkhitaryan, and they're making these sort of deals, then I guess that's kind of how you replace it in the immediacy. The difficulty with that is that, like we're saying, it's a very short-termist view of how Arsenal are going to run, because Mkhitaryan is a certain age and they can only depend on him for so long. But I really highly rate Mkhitaryan despite his time at Manchester United, and I think he'll be, you know, as prolific as he was at Borussia Dortmund if he were to come the other direction. And I think similar about Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, but yet again, he is, I think, around the same age as those two players, 28 or 29. And although I think he is likely to age gracefully, despite the fact that a pace is a large part of his game, he will, you know, it'll be a decent deal for Arsenal in the short term. Now, in the long term, it's a completely different conversation.
Can Mkhitaryan fulfill Statman Dave's prediction, though, Nico, at Arsenal?
What prediction would that be? I believe he featured a tweet, if I can find it here, because I did screenshot it. I was ready for the ban.
Of course you did.
Let me just find it real quick here. It was a nice old picture. Here we go. Of Henrik Mkhitaryan in the summer. Mkhitaryan is going to kill it next season. Will beat his best Bundesliga season of goals and assists. Hashtag MUFC. May be entirely possible at Arsenal, though.
Are you telling me that Statman Dave made another wrong prediction? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, man. Are you the man who's never wrong? It's never been me.jpg.
Famously. I mean, What do you reckon, Chris? I mean, is this a good transfer window for Arsenal? Because, of course, it was all doom and gloom, losing Sanchez, their best player. But at the same time, you know, this is a guy who isn't playing for the club, a guy who's hated by most of the dressing room, by all accounts. It's better to get rid of him, it seems, and bringing in Mkhitaryan, bringing in Aubameyang, albeit Aubameyang, a player himself who's been suspended, what, 3 times this season by Borussia Dortmund for his own misbehaviour. It does feel like it could be a good outcome in the end for Arsenal, or is this once again another false dawn almost for the Gunners? Is this false hope?
I think to address one thing first, I think Sven Mislintat has given Arsenal assurances that Aubameyang's conduct at Dortmund recently, the suspensions, the disagreements, if you will, are not in keeping with his character usually. In terms of the grander picture with Arsenal, I think it's less about whether it's a false dawn or you know, the actual heralding of a new age at the club. I think what it does do is show you that there is a certain amount of power being withdrawn from Arsene Wenger's scope and purview. I think he certainly is still a decision maker, but I think what you're seeing now is the infrastructure that was placed around him during the course of this season. Mislintat, for example, the chap from Barcelona who they brought in as well, they're starting to have more of an involvement. By all accounts, Wenger was more interested in Anthony Martial, but Manchester United understandably have no desire to get rid of him because he's still incredibly young and there's a ceiling there that I think is quite enticing, which is perhaps why Wenger wanted him. And I think that's certainly what has stuck out to me here, is that the new dawn on the pitch, I can't necessarily give a huge backing to. I think it improves them, definitely, because Aubameyang is a very good player. I think Mkhitaryan is a very good player. Those two, in my mind at least, work well together as part of a system, especially with Ozil in there as well. Potentially it makes for an interesting situation, especially if they are going to persist with a back three, and then they could even mirror Chelsea's formation with a front three, if you will, of Mkhitaryan, Ozil and Aubameyang. But yeah, I think for me the more pressing thing to take away from this is the evolution of Arsenal away from the pitch and what they will potentially move into in a few months' time with summer 2018.
Next question is from John Shin, friend of the show. Son, Heung-min Son, is currently the face of Asian footballers around the world. He's our gem in Korea. Do you see Son staying at Spurs in the long run, or do you see him having the potential to move to another club? Would this move be a move up or down the ranking scale? Very interesting question. Obviously, Heung-min Son's become an increasingly important player for Spurs this season. 8 goals, 4 assists for Mauricio Pochettino's side. He scored in 5 consecutive home games as well at Wembley. Of course, that equaliser, fantastic equaliser against West Ham. And obviously, he put in a fantastic performance most recently against Everton. As I said, an increasingly important player for Spurs. He's got this reputation of being underrated, but he sort of has, there's so many people who think he's underrated that he's almost rated now, I'd argue. I mean, what do you make of this, Nico? Because I feel like he's a player who's drawing attention now, given his end product, given the contribution to Spurs' attacking form in that final third. For me, though, it's not a gap that many Premier League sides have on that sort of left side of the attack. It's somewhere where the likes of Manchester City, Manchester United, clubs who you'd argue could poach from Spurs, they're already well stocked in that position. Do you think those Spurs could be in danger of losing Son to a potential European giant, etc.? Or do you think, you know, for me, he's fantastic at Spurs. He's got a lot of room even now for progression, for evolution. He seems to be at the perfect place under Pochettino at this side.
It's definitely an interesting one. I mean, he's a really gifted player, as you've mentioned there. He is kind of an in-betweener. He can be a forward, he can be an outside player, and he can even play in the middle. So he's really versatile in his position. He's not that old. I think probably the most interesting aspect of this one will be similar to what I said about Sanchez, because he is, as John is mentioning, they're characteristically Asian, and so he does provide an in into those kind of markets. And it's not just about selling shirts, obviously. It's about the engagement. And if a particular group of people who isn't normally represented in Premier League clubs feels represented with someone like a Spurs, then there's a lot of revenue to be gained from that, a lot of revenue streams to be sort of capitalized on. So I think Heung-min Son is a really interesting player for a lot of teams to to poach from Spurs, but at the same time, I think he's one of the players that, as I talk to more and more Tottenham fans, they feel as though there's a certain core group that is kind of sold on this long-term project with Mauricio Pochettino. So I think for your sake, as well as Tottenham's, I think he'll kind of be around for the long haul. I think he'll be there.
Good to hear. Matt Brownie Cake, another friend of the show, says, regarding the Chelsea / Norwich match, Chris, what the VAR is going on with VAR? Obviously, some controversy in the FA Cup match this week. Antonio Conte not happy with the decision from the video assistant referee against Willian with regards to the penalty. I mean, a lot of controversy surrounding this, a lot of criticism. Obviously, there's going to be teething problems implementing this system. My opinion would be that, broadly speaking, anything that can bring more fairness to the game, anything that can sort of eradicate these wildly wrong decisions is a good thing. But at the same time, there does seem to be a little bit of a consternation over it, Chris.
I understand that, because I think games like last night are the kind of situation where fans are almost exasperated with VAR, because it feels as if it's slowing down the game. It doesn't provide the definitive answer that I think they want. At the same time, there's a feeling that once you incorporate some kind of third-party element, be it video or whatever, being able to review footage, that you should get a definitive answer to something, and that it should always be right as a consequence because you're able to review it. I don't think it's that black and white, unfortunately. There are a number of instances where, and I'm sure if you went into pretty much any pub in London or wherever, you would be able to find fans who will still debate a certain incident from years ago that, again, couldn't be given a conclusion to. I think VAR has its uses, most definitely. I think it's in a slightly more streamlined situation than what it has been thus far. I don't think it should be used for everything, but I can see applications for it. And the problem is that any type of integration like this, it's not terribly dissimilar, I think, to when you are an early adopter of new software on your phone. There will be bugs, there will be kinks that have to be worked out. The problem is, obviously, that you can't necessarily allow for that and also implement it into professional sports at the same time, because there's no way you can just test it without it actually encapsulating the pace and all of the other nuances of Premier League and high-level football.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think the issue is going to be at that implementation, as you say. I think there are going to be issues when it's first being brought in, but even watching on TV when it is being used, there does seem to be a sense of confusion about what exactly is going on when it's being used, let alone, you know, when you're actually in a ground when it's being used. I think it's going to be I think it's going to take time, essentially, for people to get used to the system and for it to be used to its maximum efficiency. But it remains to be seen what happens there. Let's move on to talk about let me see if I've got a question here. Here we go. We've got a question here from Mediocre Ambition FC. He says, on a serious note, is Tammy Abraham that bad when we have to look at Carroll and Crouch for English backup strikers? Mediocre Ambition here is obviously referring to the news that Andy Carroll was a target for Chelsea. He was due for talks over a £20 million move to Stamford Bridge. However, an ankle injury has forced him out of action, meaning that deal is off. Naturally, Chelsea are turning to Peter Crouch. Stoke forward, obviously, a lot of hilarity on Twitter over this one. You know, Arsenal are going for Aubameyang. Manchester United trying to sign Sanchez. Chelsea, the champions, are going for Peter Crouch, Chris. Obviously, a bit of a surprise. What do you make of this? Does this make sense given the unreliable goal scoring form of Alvaro Morata? Is Peter Crouch the answer?
Not necessarily. I think ultimately Conte wants a different option. He wants someone that can provide perhaps a better aerial presence. And I feel bad saying that because Morata has scored a number of headers this season. I think to answer the person's question about Tammy Abraham, one of the things I believe is inhibiting them calling him back is the fact that there was a loan fee paid. From my understanding, it becomes a lot more complicated to cancel that and eradicate all of the things that are involved with that, because I think ultimately the power sits with the club who have paid the fee. Because, like I said, they've paid a fee to take Tammy Abraham on loan. What I do think is perhaps nestled in there, which is important to consider, is that actually Chelsea have been quite poor in squad management. And maybe this relates more to the recruitment team as much as Conte as well. Because you have Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who has gone out on loan, when arguably he could be, and I would say would be, doing a better job than Timu Bakayoko this season. Nathaniel Chalobah is injured, so it's unfair to point to him. Someone pointed to Dom Solanke as well, who obviously didn't get game time, so left. I think he could have been in that squad doing something. And yeah, definitely, Tammy Abraham could and should have stayed at Chelsea this season. Now, I appreciate people will point to an element of hindsight in that evaluation, but I think what it points to is the fact that Chelsea haven't been the greatest at implementing or integrating, more importantly, their young players. You look at Andreas Christensen, who, yes, he spent 2 years on loan at Gladbach, but could he have possibly done some of that learning in the Chelsea first team? I mean, he to me is a player that has fit in very seamlessly and has shown that actually, you know, playing your kids is something that I think is going to ultimately give you a reward. And it's quite a strong debate in Major League Soccer at the minute, the element of there being no relegation. So can you play your kids more? Should you play your kids more? And a lot of teams aren't. And I think ultimately you have to trust your young players at some point. And I think this is the bridge that Chelsea have forced themselves over with a lot of short-term managerial appointments, is that perhaps Emanalo was leading things for a long time, but now his departure to Monaco means that really they're operating on maybe an 18, 24-month cycle with coaches, in which you either don't or won't plan further than that because you don't envisage it being a long-term project. And I think perhaps Chelsea have to implement a structure around that, that while allowing the manager to take it in his direction, at least keeps them in the same area in terms of, or on track, sorry, in terms of youth players and their integration in the first team.
But does that, just to follow up with Chris, does that really work with Conte? Because I can definitely agree with what you're saying and agree that that probably is the right approach to take. But I think the biggest consistency that we've seen with Conte in his managerial career is sort of similar to Jose Mourinho, in the sense that if they don't like a player, and really maybe this is consistent with all managers, if they don't like a player like Michy Batshuayi, for example, or any number of the players that you rightly mentioned in, I think, your tweet earlier about, you know, that Chelsea could have used this season, then he's simply not going to use them. And he had viable striking options. He had, you know, viable midfield and even defensive options that he could have used at Chelsea's, that were at Chelsea's disposal, but he has yet to do so. So, I mean, I don't know if that works with Conte. I think Conte is the major problem here.
I do think he's not conducive, excuse me, to implementing youngsters more. And again, that, I think that goes back to the refining the process of Chelsea picking a manager. One of the things we've discussed about before is the contrast between Arsenal and Chelsea in terms of their goals and desires. And Arsenal have struggled, you could argue, for being loyal and having a long-term vision. But I think that's up for debate. I think at the same time, Chelsea have benefited from the short-termism of their managerial appointments, in the sense that they've always been striving to win, because if they're not winning, they're not doing anything. And that is proved by the fact that they've won the Champions League, they've won Premier Leagues within the start of this most recent decade. And I think it now puts them at an interesting impasse, because, as you allude to there, their approach and efforts in securing a number of promising young players with a view to sort of training them in-house and putting them into the first team. It has made them money, but at the same time, it has gone at loggerheads with their managerial approach, or their approach to hiring managers, excuse me. And that has cost them Kevin De Bruyne. It has cost them Mo Salah. You could argue it's cost them Romelu Lukaku. Three players that now would, I would say, would get into the Chelsea team, or at least be within an 18-man squad of it. And I think that's the potential drawback they have, is that they haven't been able to necessarily find a coach yet who can balance that sort of ferocious desire to win at all costs with an eye on the future and an eye on a few months, if not years, down the line for the first team. It's almost planting a tree that you will never see grow. You know, I think there's an idiom to that effect, or a Chinese saying to that effect. That's essentially what Chelsea need. And I think, yeah, they definitely don't have that with Conte.
And Max Allegri just watches on from the distance, cackling.
David Shanahan asks on the crouch topic, would this go down as the greatest transfer window in recorded history if Chelsea signed Peter Crouch, Nico? Hard to top. I mean, sure.
I think so. I think it probably would. The Surely. Only thing that we would need, I think there's a reliable Manchester City journalist, I think his name is Sam something, but he was talking about, because obviously I mentioned Fred, the central midfielder from Shakhtar Donetsk, being a Manchester City target, but someone was suggesting that they would rather sign the striker that they had signed before, the Brazilian Fred. And I think if they both moved this January to wherever, that would indeed be the greatest window.
I think the greatest window, without doubt, is 2011, when I believe Fernando Torres moved to Chelsea on deadline day. And Andy Carroll weirdly ended up at Liverpool for 35 million from Newcastle at the time. Suarez was there as well. It was complete madness. There's no way this transfer window is beating that one. I mean, if Peter Crouch signs for Chelsea, if Chelsea paid over 5 million for Peter Crouch, maybe so. But nothing's going to beat the insanity of 35 million for Andy Carroll. Liverpool paying that was just, even at that time, it was madness. And we all know.
Speaking of fantastic January deals, you know, I think Liverpool Twitter got very excited last week about a certain Naby Keita supposedly joining Liverpool, only to be thwarted by the club themselves.
This does bring me on to a related question about Philippe Coutinho. David Shanahan again, he's asking, with Liverpool seemingly choosing not to replace Coutinho in this window, will they struggle against teams that sit deep with the lack of creativity in midfield? I think they wanted to bring Naby Keita in earlier to potentially bring that element to the middle of the park for them. Obviously, it didn't work out. Leipzig announcing that he was staying until the end of the season. I mean, what do you make, Nico? Because obviously we saw Liverpool take advantage of Manchester City, to an extent, a team who liked to attack. There were spaces there for Liverpool to exploit. With teams sitting deeper, though, which you'd expect with teams further down the table, are Liverpool going to be able to have that key to unlock them without Coutinho? Do you think they're going to be able to break down teams at Anfield and elsewhere?
Well, you know, the Manchester City games aren't the problem for Liverpool with players like Philippe Coutinho and Naby Keita not being there. It's the Burnleys, it's the Crystal Palaces of the world that they need to worry about, because, you know, and I know you guys probably talked about it on the pod earlier this week, but their performance at Manchester City was perfect. And that's pretty much entirely down to Klopp and his ability to get his message through to the players. Now, as you're mentioning there, they will struggle to some extent, breaking down teams that are going to take a more compact approach to them. But at the same time, and this has shown through in the analytics for the past 2 years, the way that Liverpool creates space by creating transition, which is equally as volatile for them as much as it is the opponent, is kind of how they like to create space. So I don't think they'll struggle as much as, say, maybe a Tottenham Hotspur that take a more possession-dominant approach, that are massively sort of underperforming their expected points or expected goals, because they are creating a lot of chances against those kind of teams. But at the same time, you know, I think it'll still be difficult, but they won't struggle as much as those teams because they create space and they kind of create chances for themselves in different ways than teams are going to dominate the ball.
Interesting. Luke Bora, Chris, is asking, we are seeing the usual managerial merry-go-round again this season, Moyes, Pardew, Big Sam, etc., who have all previously done good jobs at certain clubs. What did Stoke see from Paul Lambert that warranted him getting a Premier League job? Hashtag the Front Free Podcast. What do you make of that, Chris? Has Paul Lambert got the minerals to succeed at Stoke where Mark Hughes didn't?
I just think of Graham Wesley when you say it like that. A quote about him saying that his kids don't call him dad, they call him medal winner. In terms of Paul Lambert, he's had a bit of a curious career because obviously he left Colchester having done a good job there and went to Norwich. I think actually after stuffing Norwich, I think it was 7-1 or something, and did a really good job getting them back-to-back promotions. His Villa side, from everything I can remember, were quite a turgid side to watch. And a similar scenario with Blackburn and also Wolves. I think what he will theoretically do is give them a little bit more defensive stability. Because one of the things about that Stoke side is it has Jordan Shaqiri, it has Choupo-Moting. Those two, to me, stand out as potential match winners. What Stoke lacked for my money going into Christmas and the final days of Mark Hughes was two serviceable fullbacks, which they've since got, I think, in Bauer and, his name is escaping me, the Greek fellow from Augsburg, Stefanidis, I think it is pronounced.
Yeah.
So there's an improvement there already. The difficulty I have when I watch Stoke is that I also think their midfield needs a bit of work. I don't think Darren Fletcher is cutting it anymore. So whether he can get someone in, you know, that will be an interesting thing to watch. I genuinely think that you learn a significant amount from Paul Lambert and what to expect from him with Stoke this weekend. Because I think you have to remember that he's been out of the spotlight of the Premier League for a few years now. You're looking at, 2015, I think it was, when he called time on his association with Villa. That's a long period in which he could reinvent himself. I remember Alan Pardew, after being sacked by Southampton, went on a little tour of Germany. And while it didn't reinvent him per se, it certainly taught him a few things that you saw implemented into his next position. And so I'm almost a little bit wary of prejudging him entirely, but you can't at the same time, I think, ignore the latter stages of his CV as a manager.
Another question here from Piotr Gala, long-time listener at Peter the Polish, says, assuming Aubameyang's exit, who should Dortmund sign as a replacement? What other signings should Dortmund make? But perhaps most importantly, Nico, what do Dortmund need to do to get back on track after such a tumultuous first half of the season? Is a squad overhaul necessary this summer? What do you make of that, Nico?
It's an interesting one. I was talking to a Borussia Dortmund supporter that was kind of mulling over the Aubameyang
guy.
A fellow guy. And he was kind of talking with me about the Aubameyang transfer. And I think generally the fans want to see Alexander Isak given more of a chance, but he's actually just gone out on loan to another Bundesliga club. So I think whether it be the club's intention to make him the full starter is still, you know, kind of remains to be seen. But I think to answer the second question, getting in a viable replacement and not really rushing who they put in as manager in sort of a panicky way is kind of key for them. And I think it's been very difficult for Borussia Dortmund to cope over the past couple of years because of everything that has happened. They had a vision a couple of years ago when they appointed Thomas Tuchel, and that hasn't happened. A lot of the key parts, including the man himself and several other key players, have left. But if there's any club that can come through that, I think on the other side, just fine, is Borussia Dortmund. So I'm not going to pretend as if I know who they should appoint. I'm sure there are plenty of good people out there that know, you know, the managerial game far better than I do. But I think given the management of the club over the past couple of years, I think after the summer they'll probably be fine.
Final serious question is from Sam Nash here, Chris. Will MLS ever implement a relegation/promotion system that we see on this side of the ocean, considering how many teams there will be in the league over the next couple of years via new franchises. Is that a possibility, Chris? Relegation promotion in MLS?
No, not anytime soon.
That simple, is it? We've got a question here from James, who said, what do we think about Theo Walcott to Everton? £20 million deal, Chris. Is it a good signing for them? Obviously a player who, well, I mean, arguably, did he ever reach his potential at Arsenal? Was that his ceiling? Is it a good signing under Sam Allardyce? Is he going to thrive in that system? What do you make of this move?
Yeah, I know they have Aaron Lennon in the squad, but I do think that Walcott gives them the pace that they missed. I always think back to his goal in the Champions League against Liverpool, where he basically raced from one end. Actually, excuse me, it wasn't his goal, his assist, where he raced from one end of the field and set up Adebayor. And to me, that's sort of the best of Theo Walcott, is carrying the ball, shifting through the gears, exploiting space. I don't think he achieved his potential. And I think to a certain extent, some of the blame has to go to Arsene Wenger and as a consequence, English football, because I think we have this very weird weird relationship with the different levels of the game. And I think once Theo Walcott had advanced into the Southampton first team and signed for Arsenal, that was it. He never went back. And I think that's almost the problem, is that in the vernacular, we think of going back as being a bad thing, as if it's a demotion rather than you're actually taking a moment to assess and learn. And Glenn Hoddle made this same point, that there are a lot of aspects of the mental side of the game that Theo Walcott just doesn't look well versed in, as if he hasn't been taught or trained in how to do. And I think that's because when you're a first team player, you're not going to get as much dedicated time as if you're working with, let's say, an under 23s coach, an under 18s coach, who necessarily isn't focused on winning and securing titles as much as developing players for the team. And I think that we need to develop a more fluid relationship with the different stages in our football clubs and even international teams, so that we can allow players to go to the 18s, the 23s, and learn and be taught, and not just expect them to pick every single facet of the game up on the job, playing week in, week out, because there are some things that just won't come naturally and maybe you won't learn, and can actually be easily rectified with 5 minutes on the coaching field and a couple of cones and a well-placed coach who knows what they're doing.
There's a very serious question here from Jack Maggi, Nico, who said, how many pizzas can you eat in an hour? I mean, how long is a pizza?
Pizza what?
Pizza! Pizza!
How many hour?
Yeah, I mean, how long is a piece of string? It depends how big the pizzas are. Is it a small pizza, medium, large? Surely it's only one large. It's pretty carby.
Depends how hungry.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty carby. A whole pizza. Imagine a large pizza, like a 13-inch pizza.
I've eaten a whole pizza.
Yeah, one, though. That's it. That's the answer, right? How many pizzas can you eat in an hour? One.
Like, I've eaten, I want to say, like, six or seven, like, an hour.
Pizzas? Not like slices.
No, pizzas. Slices. No, slices. Yeah,
this the Jack saying pizzas, full stop. Like,
full stop. Yeah, one pizza, I
mean, it's a boring answer, 1.5. Jack, but it's like, it makes sense. One and a half pizzas, Jesus Christ. Chris, could you eat more than one and a half pizzas in an hour?
No, despite what you might believe.
One's the max. Before we go, Chris, we should probably talk a little bit about the Newcastle United takeover, or lack thereof. I mean, what's going on with this? It all seems to have fallen apart in the last week or so. Mike Ashley seemingly putting a statement out that there is no offer on the table. Amanda Staveley seemingly suggesting through the press that there is an offer of £250 million. We're not sure if that's short of what Ashley wants. The report was there was £350 million he was demanding. Is this all just falling apart now? This is never going to happen?
Yeah, so in essence, there was talk that a bid was made in November. The latest, as I understand it, is that they are involved in a bit of he said, she said, in which Mike Ashley claims there was never actually a bid. Amanda Staveley claims that there was a written bid submitted to Mike Ashley's lawyers. And a number of different journalists and members of the press have sort of stood up what either side has said, as you can imagine, because they probably have sources who they have no reason to distrust. I think what sticks out to me is that while I'm loath and possibly don't even fully believe Mike Ashley, I can't help but shake the feeling that this situation mirrors the one that she endured with Liverpool, in which she talked of making a bid. There was a story, I think, in The National, which is a Middle Eastern paper, that said there was a bid made, only for Tom Werner of Liverpool to come out and deny that. And I think from speaking to people with knowledge of that situation, to get all cloak and dagger for a second, they have painted her as someone that, while somewhat well-connected at one stage, who did help facilitate the sale of Manchester City as sort of a broker, if you will, she is a bit of a tire kicker at the same time, and that there's been issues in the past with her when she's made grandiose promises but not been able to deliver. And I think that's where I'm at with it now. She's given an interview to The Times, which will be coming out Friday. That, to me, I don't think will dispel any of the concerns I have, because if anything, I'm inclined to think that when you look at some of the recent takeovers that have happened, West Brom, for example, Wolves in the Championship, there's not really a lot of media speculation around them. They happen quite quickly, quite efficiently for the most part, and without much of a stir in the press, because that's not usually how these businesses and organizations like to do it. So the fact that Newcastle have had this protracted, bordering on soap opera play out in the press does make me question the validity of the person trying to buy the club, because you would think, if anything, they would want to keep any discussion about the potential of a Premier League club being for sale as quiet as possible, as not to alert any potential rivals or even stoke up some potential interest.
To finish then, a few what I like to call podcast maintenance questions. Quite a few questions coming in about the front three. First off, at Left Footed asking, why does Adam host the pod once every 2 weeks? Great question, at Left Footed. The truth is, recently I got a 9-to-5 job. I got a proper job, full-time employment, which has made my ability to be free to record, to podcast, a little less flexible than it perhaps once was, unfortunately, I should say. Which also leads us on to a question from Sam Atkins. I mean, you'll be hearing a lot about this project. You will be hearing a lot about this in the coming weeks and months, I should say. But that does lead us on to a question from Sam Atkins, who says, where's Dave? Dave is a very busy man. Dave's got a YouTube channel going on. He's got a lot of different projects on the go. And unfortunately, he can only really sort of record in the day, whereas myself now with this job can only record in the evening. There's five of us involved in the front three. We're all trying to sort of move ourselves around, be as flexible as possible, try and sketch it. It's very difficult at times, but we're trying as best we can to get at least three people together every episode to get a podcast out. Stephen Alex says, can you please make sure Dave is part of the front three? Lawrence and Kirsten have done a sterling job. It would be good to have Dave's presence. I'm not sure who Kirsten is, but a good question nonetheless. There's also a question here about you, Nico. Let me try and find it here. Where is it? D108 says, when is Nico Morales going to start a YouTube channel? Also, what is up with the front free YouTube channel? First off, Nico, when are you starting a YouTube channel? The people want to know.
Oh, in the coming days.
Coming days? That soon?
In the coming days, Adam.
So mysterious. As for the front free YouTube channel, there's a relevant question here from Shane as well, who says, should I unsubscribe?
One in the same, in the coming days.
Yeah, same thing. Shane says, should I unsubscribe from the front free YouTube channel? Shane, you'd be mad to unsubscribe from the front free YouTube channel. Stay subscribed. Can't promise any video content coming anytime soon. Like I say, we're all very busy at the moment. We're all very, very busy men. But you wouldn't want to subscribe. You wouldn't want to unsubscribe now, would you? You want to just keep it there. See what happens. Let's see what happens.
It's like a nice little sentimental thing. Like every time you scroll past it, you can be like, I remember those good times when they used to upload.
Yeah. We did videos once. You never know. You might just get a surprise in your subscription box one day soon. There might be a video popping up. There might be this. There might be that. Just
Adam's favorite chat line. That.
Yeah. Tell us, people who are listening, if you're interested in a daily life of Nico vlog, I'll upload those. I'll just record it on my iPhone. Yes. Record me eating sandwiches.
I'd be pretty interested in that, to be fair.
Just, all right. Well, I'll do that then. That's what's coming in 2018. There you go.
Beautiful Orlando. I enjoy that very much. Guys, thank you so much for your questions. We answered as many as we could there. Some really interesting ones. Thank you again to our whole of the week, John Rabb. Do slide into them DMs at Adam Butler or at the Front Free to claim your Ferrero Rocher. And guys, remember, you could be in with a chance of winning those beautiful chocolates. All you have to do is rate and review the Front Free on iTunes. The link is in the description of this very podcast. Until Monday, when we're going to be back with a weekend review, as always, Chris, where can the listeners find you?
They can find me at K Hennage.
At K Hennage. Nico, where can they find you when you're not vlogging your day eating sandwiches?
In the frozen tundra that is Orlando.
Yeah, very cold, famously cold there. Guys, you can find me at Adam Boltwood. You can also find us all at The Front Free. Until Monday, have a bloody great weekend.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.